listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, if you've ever made your way down the tight aisles on an airplane to use the bathroom, you know that both the walkway and the lavatory are cramped and small. We talk with a reporter about the obstacles in travel for those with disabilities and a few ways technology is making things easier for some of the time. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news, and with the primary just a little over 3 weeks away, we're going to focus on the run for governor. Monday was the deadline for mid-year fundraising reports, and on Wednesday, the Marquette Law School released their latest poll, which included a look at how gubernatorial hopefuls are faring with gaining support from voters. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capital Bureau Chief, and he's with us in the studio to give us the latest. Sean, thanks for coming in.
Hi, Judith.
So let's start with those financial reports that candidates had to file by Monday. What information is included in them?
What you see in those reports is how much money people donated to them or committees donated to them or they donated to themselves between January 1st and June 30th of this year. So it's a snapshot of how these campaigns were operating, all eight of them now on the Democratic side. And then you've got the governor, of course, who's kind of in a different world there on the Republican side, how they were operating in the first half of this year, who they're reaching out to, who's supporting them.
And as you said, there are eight Democrats still in the race, and then Governor Walker, and he does have a primary challenger. Let's start with the Dems. Who came out on top for total money raised in those 6 months?
So I'd say, first of all, it kind of depends on what you look at. But if you look at just sheer dollars, Kelderoy's had the best, you know, 6 months of 2016. And she raised about $668,000, she had $668,000 cash on hand and raised about that much, too. So she was first, followed by, in terms of cash on hand, Matt Flynn, Malin Mitchell, and Tony Evers. Those were the candidates that raised in six-figure sums. Everybody else was below six-figure sums. So you kind of have, again, strictly in campaign fundraising, you've got kind of two tiers that developed in terms of who has money and who doesn't.
Mm-hmm. And for those that were in that kind of second tier, how much under six figures were they?
Well, in some cases, you know, way below. So you got, Josh Paid was, in his initial finance report, was actually running a deficit. He filed an amended report, so he's slightly above zero. Kathleen Vineout had just about $21,000 cash to, you know, as of June 30th. So, you know, just to put that in some context, you're talking about that's how much money these campaigns have for that final push to the August 14th primary. That's why that cash on hand figure is so relevant right now, is it's going to be a shortened campaign at this point. Mm-hmm. Who's going to be able to do it? The other candidates that were down there, Paul Soglin had about $58,000. Mike McCabe had $68,000. McCabe also gave some money to himself.
Mm-hmm. And so, as you said, you know, we're coming up on this primary. What do candidates generally use their cash on hand for, as in the, you know, final weeks leading up to that primary?
Some of them are going to use it for ads. You've already got three candidates now who have come out and put some TV ads up there. Tony Evers, Kelderoy's, Matt Flynn. All three of those candidates, by the way, have given some of their own money to their campaign. So that's part of the reason they're able to afford this stuff. Kelderoy's gave about $350,000 to herself. Matt Flynn, $140,000. Tony Evers, $100,000. That's a lot of money for a person to give their own campaign, right?
And is it giving or is it loaning?
It's loaning in some cases.
Okay.
In these cases, they are loans. And so if they were to win the nomination, they would be able to fundraise and they would be able to pay down
themselves.
Those personal loans. If they don't win, it's a lot harder to get people to pay off your campaign debt.
I think we saw that with Governor Walker. It wasn't to pay off a debt, but he was trying to pay off campaign debt, not a loan, after he left the presidential election.
Yeah, in his case, it wasn't personal money that he'd put in, but he had a debt in his federal campaign that he spent a lot of time paying down. In this case, it's personal money that they put in there. And it is a lot of money for a person, but it doesn't buy a lot on TV. You're not talking about a multi-million dollar campaign for any of these people. They are in the hundreds of thousands. And so it's an open question as to how much a TV ad is going to get noticed in that size of an ad buy in the middle of summer.
Hmm. And on the Republican side, as we said, Governor Walker is being challenged by Robert Meyer. What did Meyer report for fundraising?
A bit of a fundraising gap on the Republican side. Robert Meyer had $114 that he gave to himself. Governor Walker had $5.9 million in the bank and had raised $5.5 million in the first 6 months of 2018.
We're talking with Sean Johnson right now. He's WPR's Capital Bureau Chief. We're talking about the fundraising reports, that the financial reports that candidates for governor had to file this week. And Sean, this week we also saw the latest Marquette Law School poll being released. And not surprisingly, there were quite a few questions that related to the primary coming up. From looking at the Marquette Law School poll results, do voters know who they're going to vote for on August 14th for governor?
According to the Marquette poll, a lot of them do not. I mean, the leading vote getter in the Democratic primary is still undecided, if you want to break it down that way. There were 38% of voters who said they weren't sure who they're going to vote for. These are Democratic primary voters, self-identified, who said they don't know who they're going to vote for in the race for governor. It was a decent poll, though, for Tony Evers, who polled at 31%. Now, again, that's there are enough undecided voters to overcome his margin, and the election's a month away. It's not like he won it already. Mm-hmm. But if you look at where Evers is at, he's been climbing in that poll, and you don't see, at least in the polls, like a clear second place challenger to kind of challenge him, and they don't have much time.
Am I remembering correctly, Sean, that he was the only one that was in double digits?
Yeah, the second place finisher in the Marquette poll, it was a tie between Malin Mitchell and Kathleen Beinhout. They had 6% each. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit of a gap to overcome, obviously. The Senate race is a little tighter. There's a Republican Senate race between Kevin Nicholson, Leah Vukmir, and Vukmir was up on Nicholson 34% to 32%. Again, though, 30% undecided in that race. So in the middle of summer, people are thinking about other things.
Well, and going back to those undecideds on the Dem side for governor, it maybe it falls within the margin of error, but I think it was the undecided was actually a couple percentage points higher than it was in the last market poll.
Yeah, that was weird. And, you know, the pollster Charles Franklin cautioned us all, don't make too much of that. You know, like 4% is not, with the margin of error in this sample, is not enough to get excited about. But, of course, you're going to look at it and not, you know, see that line is not going the other way, that there's not more people making up their minds, at least in that result, that there are more people who don't know.
Do you see movement? I mean, there are the numbers in the poll and you know, other indicators like fundraising, but do you see any of the Dems doing a better job than the others in kind of boosting their name recognition and getting in front of the voters in a way that, I mean, they have to differentiate themselves from seven other Dems, let alone from Governor Walker?
I think ads are one way to do that. You know, having that money gives you a chance at least to come out and say to more people, I'm the person for you. There is a little bit of a juxtaposition, between the way that the race is perceived, like in Democratic circles, for example, and what you see borne out in these poll numbers. For example, Kelder Royce won the straw poll at the state Democratic convention, won some other smaller straw polls at county conventions, has gotten some big endorsements from, you know, like Emily's List, which endorses female candidates nationwide, has a lot of things that she would be able to point to and say, I have momentum. But in the, you know, a larger electorate, it's not showing up in those Marquette polls. And maybe, you know, somebody like Royce or Mitchell or Flynn, who have the resources to put behind it, maybe that's the kind of thing that they can put together as more people start paying attention to. But so far, it's not.
Mm-hmm. I should say that we have invited all of the candidates for governor, both Democratic and Republican, because they have contested primaries, to come on Central Time in the 2 weeks prior to the primary. So that's another way that people can get their message out to the voters. Hopefully they will all accept. So as we said, you know, it's summer. Maybe not the greatest time for people to be focusing on politics, but the governor's race is a pretty high stakes race. And Governor Walker has been, you know, a fairly polarizing person. Would you expect there to be more excitement or something on the Democratic side?
The rest of the world doesn't always operate on your expectations when you follow this stuff day in, day out. You know, an eight-person primary on the Democratic side may not be somebody's idea of fun, right? it's a big race, and I think anytime you get closer to the general election, that intensity will increase. You know, you may not feel it out there, see it out there among Republicans or among Democrats in these Senate or these governor's races right now, but as we approach the general election, it's just like it's a rule of nature that you know, people will become more intensely focused on these races. I don't think that'd be any different this year.
And here we are a little over 3 weeks out from the primary. Sean, do you expect anyone to drop out before we get to primary day?
That is a good question. I mean, they haven't done it at this point. And so you can kind of go through the list and say, well, if they haven't done it by now, why would they? Mm-hmm. Kind of. I mean, and I think for me, all of those candidates sort of check that off. You know, you look at Kathleen Vinehouse, she doesn't have any money really to speak of. And she's been asked by people, hey, are you going to get out of the race? But she's polling at second place for what mm-hmm. it's worth in the Marquette poll. And she's already announced she's not going to run for her state Senate race. So she's got nothing to lose. Why would she mm-hmm. at this point? Unless she had a front runner that she really wanted to throw her support behind. So, you know, personally, I look at all the names and I think kind of, why would they at this mm-hmm. point?
Might as well stick it out.
Right.
Well, before we wrap up, Sean, we got news today that Mike Ellis passed away. He served the Neenah area in the state Senate for over 30 years, was president of the Senate for the last 4 years of his career. What kind of legacy is he leaving behind in Wisconsin politics?
Oh, Mike Ellis had a very big personality in the Capitol. I mean, he was known for being a booming speaker. He knew the way state government worked better than anybody, and he really liked to use that. I sort of perceived him as a friendly adversary to Scott Fitzgerald, the majority leader, from time to time. You know, he would kind of be a thorn in leadership's side because he knew so much and because he liked to mix it up. But Fitzgerald was the first person to come out with a statement today announcing the passing of Mike Ellis. And Fitzgerald said, quote, "Everything I learned about leadership and politics, I learned from Senator Ellis." Fitzgerald called him a friend and a mentor. Democrats also praising Ellis. This is Democratic Party Chair Martha Lanning. She said, quote, "Wisconsin's legislature has seen many greats, but the passing of Mike Ellis is a terrible loss." So you're seeing a lot of that from people who got to know him over his 44-year career.
Well, Sean, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He joined us to take a look at how candidates for governor are doing financially and with getting their message out to likely voters. A trip to the airport often requires a lot of planning ahead. You'll need a ride and you'll need good timing. And once you're there, it's a matter of checking in, going through security, and finally getting to the gate. For those with disabilities, whether physical or mental, traveling often requires extra planning and research, allowing extra time and asking lots of questions. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a person with disabilities who travels? What's your experience been like, either on planes or buses or trains? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Joshua Brockman is a business, technology, and health reporter who contributes itineraries columns for the New York Times. His most recent piece is called "For Disabled Travelers, Technology Helps Smooth the Way, But Not All of It." Joshua, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much for having me.
For those who don't have disabilities, it might be hard to imagine what some of the challenges are for someone who, for example, might be in a wheelchair or might have a difficulty seeing. From what you've learned in talking with people, what is the travel experience like for people with disabilities?
Right. Well, I did have an opportunity to interview a variety of disabled travelers about their experiences taking airplanes, trains, and buses. And one of the travelers I interviewed, his name is Michael May, and he's the executive director for Envision's BVI Workforce Innovation Center. That's a center in Wichita, Kansas, that provides employment training for the blind and visually impaired. And he's a veteran traveler. He is on the road almost weekly on an airplane. I've seen him in action. He uses a cane and a golden retriever guide dog, but he's also a very technologically savvy, and he relies on apps for booking travel. He gets to the airport by hailing a ride on Uber, and he really navigates as best he can by doing as much independent work on his own before he gets to the actual airport or a travel center. But of course, you know, getting to the airport is a different story. He told me how he really hits a void when he gets at gets to the airport, because basically he has to ask someone how to get to TSA pre-check or to clear. As you can imagine, airports are frenzied places, and even if you ask someone for directions, not everybody is so helpful. So, you know, that gets to another point, which is that a lot of disabled travelers that I interviewed take the time to enroll in TSA's pre-check program or in this other program called CLEAR to help speed things along.
And I have to say, I think there are assumptions that the Americans with Disabilities Act covers pretty much everything in the United States. But I was actually interested and surprised to read that it doesn't apply to some aspects of travel. What does the ADA govern as far as transportation, and what doesn't it?
Right. That is a surprise for many people. The Americans with Disabilities Act does apply to airports and to ground transportation. So that includes trains, buses, subways, and airport terminals. But of course, airline cabins, that's another story entirely. Those are governed by what's called the Air Carrier Access Act. And to further add to the somewhat complicated landscape, it's the Department of Transportation that has oversight over the Air Carrier Access Act, and the Department of Justice actually has oversight over the Americans with Disabilities Act. You know, what this really means for people with disabilities is you know, when you're in an airline cabin, I had the opportunity to speak with Lee Page, who's a quadriplegic who uses a wheelchair full time. And he summed it up in an incredible way by saying that the most accessible thing on an airplane is the fact that the armrest actually lifts up. Mm. You know, the bottom line about these two pieces of legislation and how they pertain to travel for people with disabilities is that what we're seeing now is that passengers are starting to make there are fraudulent claims that are happening about needing to use emotional support animals, and that coupled with sort of the rise of untrained animals or pets and some new regulations that airlines have imposed for transporting service and support animals, you know, to compensate for what they think are shortcomings in some of these DOT regulations, all of this takes a toll on disabled travelers who really rely on service animals.
Well, and also in reading about this topic, I noticed that it's not just disabled travelers who are saying, you know, there needs to be more accommodation, it needs to be safer and easier. It's actually flight attendants who are also saying, look, this is actually a danger, not just for people with disabilities, but for us and for other passengers.
Right. So flight attendants are a key part of the equation in terms of travel for people with disabilities, because it's part they're sort of on the front lines of how disabled passengers are communicating with airline staff, especially during the flight. I mean, I'll give you an example. Another profile of someone that appears in my story is Teresa Blankmeyer Burke. She teaches at Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C., and she's deaf. And basically, she told me that one of the biggest challenges she faces is sort of missing information. I mean, if we think about all the audio announcements that are made in airports, she relies basically on announcements that are disseminated via text message. And some airports also do have visual paging screens. But what she does is when she travels, she prints out a script. And she basically tells flight attendants in that about her communication needs, her preferences, where she's going. And she also makes it clear that she wants important announcements written down. And she asks who's going to be responsible for communicating with her in the event of an emergency. So she's very proactive about it and takes steps to make sure that it can be as pleasant an experience as possible.
We're talking with reporter Joshua Brockman about the challenges that people with disabilities face when they are doing long-distance travel. And it sounds like, I wouldn't be surprised, I should say, that different airports are very different experiences for people with disabilities, because different airports are very different experiences for anyone. And some are much easier to get around in and some are not. Are there some airports that kind of stand out as places that are much more easy for people with disabilities to navigate?
Well, that's a great question, and it is one that I posed to a number of the travelers that I interviewed. You know, rather than single out a single airport, I think it's helpful to kind of talk about some of the trends that they do see at at many of the airports. Although I will say that you know, one of the airports that is doing trying to do things on the future and on the frontier is the SeaTac airport. I mentioned them in my article as well. In that they're doing a partnership with a company called Aira, and this is a monthly subscription app that basically uses a smartphone camera or a pair of glasses that's outfitted with a camera to live stream video to an agent who provides navigational instructions to the blind and visually impaired. And what's interesting here is the company has struck up partnerships with more than a dozen airports. The list keeps growing. So for your listeners, the closest airport is probably Minneapolis, but the airports also include Boston, Seattle. And this is something that Michael May, who I mentioned earlier, he uses Aira, and he also uses another free app called Be My Eyes, which has, believe it or not, a network of 1.2 million volunteers who provide the same type of directions via live video.
Hmm.
The other thing that I just should say about disabled travelers is that the screen reader software, which is something that appears, you know, that is on smartphones, is really a critical piece of the technology toolkit. On iPhones, for example, there's an accessibility program called VoiceOver, and what that does is it basically reads what appears on the screen, and then there are specific gestures to learn to use it most effectively.
And Joshua, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Joshua Brockman is a business, technology, and health reporter who contributes to the Itineraries column for the New York Times. He joined us to talk about his recent piece about challenges that travelers with disabilities face. This piece and his other work can be found at kayaknew.com. The House Veterans Affairs Committee announced an investigation this week into the quality of care at VA nursing homes around the country. The move comes after an investigation from USA Today and the Boston Globe that showed nearly half of all VA nursing homes get a one-star rating from the agency itself, the lowest possible. And records show the three homes in Wisconsin didn't get high marks, with Madison getting 3 stars and Milwaukee and Toma receiving 2. Donovan Slack is one of the 2 reporters to break this story. She's USA Today's Veterans Affairs and Homeland Security correspondent, and she's with us now to talk about the story. Donovan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, your original investigation was based in part on documents that you and your colleagues at the Boston Globe got a hold of. What did those documents show?
Well, as you mentioned already, they showed that the agency has been ranking its nursing homes internally for a while, and they were not faring very well in comparisons with the private sector. As you said, specifically on a scale of 1 to 5, nearly half of them, 60, received only 1 out of 5 stars for quality.
And why were those ratings kept secret in the first place?
Well, that's a really good question. It took me a long time, months, to get my hands on them. And they were just held very tightly to the vest by the VA. Now, this agency is not always forthright, as we know from the past. And when I approached them, I want to say it was almost a year ago, and I said, hey, I understand these ratings exist. Can I have them? And they replied, oh, no, no, no. They're not ready for prime time. We can't release them. So then I set about, as I said, spending months working sources and trying to get these internal documents. And when I did get them, it became clear that this quality was obviously a factor, and they're not wanting to release them.
Well, and we're talking about comparing them to privately owned nursing homes and their ratings or rankings, which leads me to believe that that information is public. Where is the sense of how well private nursing homes are doing? Where's that information coming from?
Right. So the Federal Department of Health and Human Services has a federal website called Nursing Home Compare. And nearly 15,000 nursing homes across the country that are privately owned submit their data, and they have quality measures and star rankings for private homes.
And are those required, those 15,000 or so, are they required to submit that, or is that voluntary?
Yeah, no. Under federal regulations, they're required to submit it if they want to get Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement for their care, and nearly all of them do.
So people who might be looking to find a suitable nursing home for a loved one can use that database and find out a lot of detail on the privately held or privately owned nursing homes, but they can't find any of that information on the VA.
Exactly. It was like a black hole. And it's extraordinary the amount of information that you can find on that website about private homes, including inspection reports, 3 years worth, as I said, the quality indicators. It's a really great place to start for people who are looking to place a loved one.
So we looked through the database that you and your colleagues compiled of how different nursing homes are rated at a handful of different metrics, and some of the statistics for Wisconsin's VA nursing homes were pretty shocking. Almost 47% of short-stay residents at a Milwaukee nursing home reported serious pain in the first 5 days, or in the last 5 days, compared to 13% in the private nursing homes. At Toma, nearly 46% of residents there received antipsychotic drugs, compared to 16% in the private sector. Those are some huge disparities. What would you attribute those to?
Right. And so you bring up Toma and the 45% on antipsychotic meds. I actually did some research this afternoon. That is the fourth highest in the nation out of 133 VA nursing homes. Mm. It's really cause for concern. But all of these indicators are just touch points. They are signals that there could be larger problems with the quality of care. If that many of your residents need antipsychotic meds, then maybe we're not managing the rest of the care as well. So it's a starting point to start asking questions, not only for family members whose you know, loved ones are staying there, but for the public and for members of Congress and people like you and me.
This week, Toma VA's acting director, James McLean, told WPR it wasn't fair to compare the VA to nursing homes in the private sector. Here's what he had to say.
We don't transfer them to another hospital. We are a hospital, so we provide that service in-house.
Donovan, do you find that argument convincing?
No. Because the hospital has nothing to do with the nursing home and these ratings. These ratings are specifically about the nursing home. And in some cases, the VA has said, well, we have sicker residents, which is, I think, what he was alluding to. You know, they've been in the war, they have combat wounds, and maybe they have, you know, different diseases than civilian residents. And there may be something to that. You know, we need some experts to do some research in that area. But in general, like some of these indicators, and one of them that I find particularly alarming is bed sores. And this is when a resident is not really mobile and develops an ulcer or a sore that can fester and go all the way to the bone. There's no reason for this, no matter what battle wounds you have. What it means is that these residents are not being moved enough. They are sitting in the same place to the point where they develop sores. And that, to me, is just, you know, it's sad.
Is that indicative of being understaffed? Is that indicative of negligence? Could it be a combination of both?
It could be either or both, as you say.
Donovan Slack is the Veterans Affairs and Homeland Security correspondent for USA Today. She was part of a team that broke a story about very low ratings for VA nursing homes, especially compared with the private sector. And what do we know? I think one of the things, Donovan, that was so shocking to me was that this was the agency's own rating system that they were performing so poorly under. What do we know about what goes into that rating of 1 to 5 stars for these VA nursing homes?
Well, so they're based on these quality indicators, which is what I was talking about, rates of infection, rates of these sores, rates of falls with major injury. There's 11 of them, and some are for long-stay residents, some are for short-stay residents. And what the agency does is, depending on how you score on any one of those, they give you a certain amount of points, and then the VA nursing homes that are over a certain amount of points get one star or five, depending on how that comes out.
And it sounds like from your looking into this that the star rating system is relatively new. Do we know what led to that system?
Well, this has been a source of some confusion. These quality indicators, the rates of bed sores and infection, the agency has actually been measuring for almost a decade, if not longer. The star rating system is something they started more than 2 years ago. They changed the way they assigned stars more recently, like 6 months ago. And so when the VA talks about the star rating system being new, they're talking about this new version of it. It's kind of dancing around, if you will.
We're talking with Donovan Slack of USA Today about her reporting that showed the VA's low ratings for almost half of its own nursing homes. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a veteran who's spent time at one of these facilities, or perhaps you have a loved one who has? What was the experience like? What do you think of the VA's record for caring for veterans? And what do you want to see change about the way we treat the men and women who've served? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation here on Central Time in just a minute. We're continuing our conversation with USA Today's Donovan Slack about the quality of care at VA nursing homes. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a loved one at a VA nursing home? If so, what was it like trying to decide where to place them? And did you have a hard time finding information out about the facility that you were considering? Call 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Pam on Facebook said, about 20 years ago, a friend of mine with a nursing and accounting background was hired by the Wisconsin VA to scrutinize and make recommendations to improve care. She was extremely frustrated when they said thank you and shelved her recommendations. And Donovan, do we know what kind of oversight is there, or you know, do they have people who are looking to improve these pretty dismal quality of care?
Well, unfortunately, her experience is not unique. This agency does study after study and report after report, and then maybe leadership turns over, and then they just sit on a shelf. But more specifically, oversight of its nursing homes has been basically non-existent because, you know, the people that would do it, whether it's members of Congress or the public, didn't even know really that they existed. You know, separate from the hospital system, which has experienced horrible problems in the last few years. But there is, right now, you would expect that they would undergo inspections, which they do once a year. But before now, those inspections, done by a Wisconsin-based company,
exactly.
By the
way, I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. Those are just kept secret. They have been. Now, the VA says they're going to release them. I have yet to see them, and they have not been made public. But all of these touch points where the public or oversight might be done haven't been there.
What do we know about that Wisconsin company, Long-Term Care Institute, that is doing these annual reports?
I mean, they've been doing it, I want to say, for more than a decade at the VA. They don't just inspect VA nursing homes. They are long-term specialists with healthcare specializations, and they do very comprehensive work from everything I'm told. But I don't think that any of their results are public, certainly not about the VA, so it's hard to judge.
And Donovan, I guess maybe we should have talked about this in the beginning. Do we know overall how many veterans are being cared for in VA nursing homes across the country?
Well, this surprised me when I found out there was 46,000 per year that are treated at a VA nursing home, whether they're residents or they're a short-stay rehabilitation patient. And they're in 46 states plus the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico.
And do we know how that compares with the demand for a bed in one of those nursing homes?
I have not heard of shortages of beds. They may be out there, but I have heard where veterans and their families, they're offered these options, and they're not really told a lot about it. You know, one of the veterans' wives who I spoke with said that when she placed her husband at the VA, she was just told how great it was and he was going to be really well taken care of. There was no way for her to double check that, no website for her to look at. And she checked him in, and within 3 months, he walked out a broken door and he hasn't been found since. And she just had to declare him dead.
Let's go to the phone, and Bill in De Pere is up first. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, hi. My dad was a Korean War veteran, and we kept him away from the VA for his whole life. It's been a nightmare as long as I can remember, and it doesn't matter whether it's a Democratic or a Republican administration, whether it's Obama or Clinton or Bush, it's always the same. It's time that they privatize the whole thing. The government's pretty good at inspecting things, but they're terrible at running most things. So I would just privatize the VA and have them inspect it just like any other private facility.
Thank you very much for that call, Bill. And Donovan, I mean, there obviously the VA facilities are being treated differently as far as transparency goes. That's the main bulk of your reporting. Have there been calls over the years or recently about changing the entire structure of the VA? Because there have been, as Bill said, there have been ongoing problems.
Right, and he brings up a fantastic few points, the first of which is that this is a nonpartisan issue. This has happened during Republican and Democratic administrations, and the call for privatization is right now the hottest debate about the VA. As we speak, there is a bill in Congress that's set to fund an overhaul of the agency that would not privatize it, but would privatize services when the VA can't provide them. And the biggest fight right now, and it's stuck, it's not moving, is that the Democrats fear that the Republicans in charge right now will privatize it. The Republicans fear the Democrats just want it to stay the way it is. It's just a really big debate right now.
And I want to talk about that investigation, that congressional investigation. But I want to go back to one of the personal stories you heard, because, yes, this is a huge bureaucracy and thousands of people, but it really comes down to these individuals and their families. You spoke to Don Rook, a Vietnam veteran who was at a nursing home in California, who told you about a wound he had on his leg that his doctor at the VA had repeatedly minimized. Here he is.
A wound that you would get in the field, in the infantry in Vietnam, not what you're expecting to have happen to you while you're in the care of medical professionals that are supposed to be looking out for my best interests.
So you can hear the emotion in his voice. What? How did his story end?
Oh, gosh. Well, it ended well. His family just fought for months and got him transferred to a private nursing home paid for by the VA. But Don's was a particularly compelling story. I saw his medical records. I saw the wound. It's not just something he's talking about. And it's absolutely horrifying. He was in a VA nursing home in Livermore, California, last year. And within 3 months of his family placing him there, he ended up at intensive care at a local private hospital at Stanford, Valley Care. And he was suffering from severe malnutrition. He had sores on his pelvis and his back. These are those sores, bed sores. And he had this wound that it had clearly festered for a long time. And Don told me his provider, his caregivers were just telling him, oh, it's all good, it's just a little bruise. And when he saw the picture himself, he just went from trusting to terrified. I mean, he's paralyzed from the waist down, I should say that. So he couldn't feel this sore developing on his lower leg. So he asked a doctor one day, could he take a picture of it and show it to him? And that's when he said his heart nearly stopped and he thought he was going to die.
As we said, Donovan, the latest news is that the House Veterans Affairs Committee is opening an investigation into these issues. What have you heard from lawmakers in reaction to what you and your colleagues reported?
They have been mostly taken aback, shocked, Many have written to the VA asking for more information about their local nursing homes. They called for this investigation. And so, as you say, the House VA committee is going to look into it. They're expecting to have a hearing sometime this fall. And so the public is going to be able to have oversight over what's happening here where it hasn't before.
So as we have been talking about, these VA nursing home ratings have not been made available to the public, but were they not even shared with the Veterans Affairs Committee?
No. And the VA committee had no idea they existed.
Oh, they didn't even know they existed.
As far as I can tell.
So the VA spokesperson has said that they'll release those inspection reports from the Long-Term Care Institute. As you said, is there any timeline applied to that? And is the Veterans Affairs Committee going to push for that?
I'm sure they will. Well, the most recent thing I heard from the VA is that they were working with a private contractor to remove, I guess, identifiable patient information from these. And it's gone on, though, almost 6 weeks since they said they were going to release them. So we just don't know yet.
Donovan, when you talked to veterans, what changes did they want to see? What thoughts did they have about what might at least start to fix this problem?
The ones I've spoken with just want there to be sunshine. They want fellow veterans and their families to know before they check their loved one in what the quality of that nursing home is, and be able to choose between that and maybe going to another one that's nearby, but that has much higher quality. And, I mean, that's their biggest, aside from improving the care of the VA nursing homes themselves, which is a no-brainer, what they want. Specifically, Don Rook, the one with the wound, said he just doesn't want anyone else to have to go through that, and he wants the care improved at VA nursing homes. But I think it's going to be a long process, particularly with the VA at this point denying a lot that they have a problem.
As we start to wrap up, Donovan, you know, we live in an age of people writing online reviews for just about everything. Are you aware of any efforts among veterans' families to share information about what their own experiences have been in these VA nursing homes?
No, not right now. There may be, it may come, but there's no Yelp, as it were, for VA nursing homes at this point.
And Donovan, as we wrap up, when do you see it ending as far as the investigation?
As I said, I expect them to have a hearing in the fall. I don't expect the issue to end after that. We're keeping our eyes right now on legislation that senators actually passed that would force the VA to release all of its nursing home information.
And we'll leave it there. Donovan Slack is the Veterans Affairs and Homeland Security correspondent for USA Today. She talked with us about her investigation showing that the VA has rated almost half of its own nursing homes with the lowest possible ratings and have kept those ratings secret for many years. We'll keep following that story.